All right. Good morning, everyone. Hope you're all ready to get back into the book of Proverbs this morning. We will be picking up with our topic of the week. This week, we are looking at what I've entitled the Heart of Anger. And we're going to go through the Proverbs. And I'd like to begin by reading to you some of the Proverbs, quite a few of the Proverbs, that speak to the topic of anger. You'll see a number of different synonyms used for the word anger. And I've even included a couple of passages that speak to things that are sort of related to anger, like getting revenge and things like that. So let me read through our text this morning. We will be looking at many of these in the course of a lesson, but I just want to give you sort of the overall picture as we read through all these. Let me begin by reading God's Word. A quick-tempered man does foolish things, and a crafty man is hated. A patient man has great understanding, but a quick-tempered man displays folly. A king delights in a wise servant, but a shameful servant incurs his wrath. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. A hot-tempered man stirs up dissension, but a patient man calms a quarrel. A king's wrath is a messenger of death, but a wise man will appease it. Better a patient man than a warrior, a man who controls his temper than one who takes the city. A man's wisdom gives him patience. It is his glory to overlook an offense. A king's rage is like the roar of a lion, but his favor is like dew on the grass. A hot-tempered man must pay the penalty. If you rescue him, you will have to do it again. A king's wrath is like the roar of a lion. He who angers him forfeits his life. Do not make friends with a hot-tempered man. Do not associate with one easily angered, or you may learn his ways and get yourself ensnared. Do not gloat when your enemy falls. When he stumbles, do not let your heart rejoice, or the Lord will see and disapprove and turn his wrath away from him. Do not say, "I'll do to him as he's done to me. I'll pay that man back for what he did." If your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. If he's thirsty, give him water to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. A malicious man disguises himself with his lips, but in his heart he harbors deceit. Though his speech is charming, do not believe him, for seven abominations fill his heart. His malice may be concealed by deception, but his wickedness will be exposed in the assembly. Mockers stir up a city, but wise men turn away anger. A fool gives full vent to his anger, but a wise man keeps himself under control. An angry man stirs up dissension, and a hot-tempered one commits many sins. As churning the milk produces butter, and as twisting a nose produces blood, so stirring up anger produces strife. And that's a reading of God's Word for this morning. We've been looking at the book of Proverbs, and we've seen that the book of Proverbs was written to give us wisdom, and that wisdom is what gives us skill and knowledge that we need to deal with the complexities of life, even in areas outside of what is moral or immoral. Today, we'll look at what Proverbs has to say about the subject of anger and the wisdom concerning anger. I called this the heart of anger as a sort of play on words, because we're going to try to get to the heart of what lies behind anger, what makes anger work, and I'll give you an outline in just a moment here. But the play on words is that anger, like all emotions, emanate out of the heart. Remember, the Hebrew idea of heart is who we are, our inner being, our motivations. And so if we want to get to what anger is, and we want to understand it rightly, and we want to deal with it the way we ought to, we can't just deal with the surface. We can't deal with outer behaviors. We have to go to the heart itself. And so that's what we hope to do today. Our basic outline is we're going to begin by looking at the power and purpose of anger. We're going to look at when anger is good. That may be a surprising title for some of you. We're going to see how anger goes wrong. And we're going to see how to heal your anger. And then we're going to take a look, in preparation for the Lord's Supper, at the ultimate anger. So that's our basic topics that we'll be dealing with today, beginning with the power and purpose of anger. Just a couple of quotations here. I like to begin with definitions. These are not real formal definitions. I could have taken time and thought about taking time to go through the Hebrew words and all that, but I thought this would just be more of a working definition that would be helpful. Lou Priolo, in a book called The Heart of Anger, I mentioned this in the first hour. It's a book teaching parents to deal with angry children, but he has a lot of very helpful principles on anger, and he defines anger in this way. He says, anger is an emotion that God gives us for the purpose of destroying something. And then many of you know that Proverbs series, I've gotten a lot of ideas and inspiration, if you will, from Tim Keller. And we heard Tim at Christmas time. I played you an audio of one of his sermons. He's a pastor in New York City. And he had a sermon in Proverbs on anger, and I got a lot of ideas from him. And one of them being this definition, anger is the dynamic of the soul, and as a result, it has the power to disintegrate things. Anger is the dynamite of the soul, and as a result, it has the power to disintegrate things. Basically, they're saying the same thing, just Keller has a more colorful way of saying it, doesn't he? You see the idea there that anger has the power of destruction in many realms of life. We want to just illustrate that by walking you through some of those texts we looked at earlier, only we're going to bring them up in categories. First thing we want to see is that anger, like other strong emotions, can disintegrate your body, literally. This passage says, a patient man has great understanding, but a quick-tempered man displays folly. And then there's a sort of parallel with the next verse. A heart at peace, that's parallel to the patient man, gives life to the body, but envy, or the word translated envy there in the NIV, could be translated passion, and it could include the idea of anger, rots the bones. And the idea of rotting the bones is going to the core of your body and destroying it, as it were. And many of you are familiar with the fact that there's all kinds of research, even in our day, medically speaking, those of you who have medical backgrounds will recognize this, no doubt. All kinds of research shows that anger is harder on your body and heart than anxiety, sorrow, or any other emotion. It's harder on your heart than extreme physical exertion. Nothing sets you up for heart disease and heart attacks, and nothing rots your bones and disintegrates your body like anger. I won't try to prove that. Again, it's sort of common wisdom. It's almost like fruits and vegetables are good for you. Now, this is just one of those things that it's pretty easy to see the effect there. And sometimes people underestimate how much they have crippled their own health, not so much by what they did or didn't do physically, though that's obviously a factor, but just the kind of attitudes that they have in their hearts, the kind of outlooks that they habitually have. And if you are a person who is prone to much anger, especially anger that's turned inward, as we'll discuss later, you are destroying yourself, physically even. But there's more than that. Anger not only disintegrates the body, but it disintegrates the community. And we see illustrations of that. For example, it says, a hot-tempered man stirs up dissension, but a patient man calms a quarrel. What are we talking about here? We're talking among people. Someone who's hot-tempered, he stirs up disagreements and fights and troubles amongst the people of the community, whether it be the church community or just a general workplace, where the family, where have you. Any community in which a hot-tempered man operates, he stirs up trouble. He stirs up fights. He stirs up dissension. Whereas the opposite of a hot-tempered man, a patient man, a long-suffering man, a slow-to-anger man, is a man who calms quarrels and calms relationships and builds community and builds harmony. We've all seen this. This is not news to us, but the Proverbs spell this out for us. There's others. It says, mockers stir up a city. In contrast, wise men turn away anger. So the implication of the parallel here is that mockers are stirring up a city by means of anger. They're angry. They're inciting anger in the people around, and they're stirring things up in a bad way. In contrast to that, wise men turn away anger. They calm people down. They deal with anger in a different way, and it's helpful. The mockers are destroying the community. Anger is destructive. This is similar to the first one. An angry man stirs up dissension. And then the last one I read to you, I like it. It's so colorful and poetic. As churning the milk produces butter, And as twisting a nose produces blood, so stirring up anger produces strife. You know, we don't make butter anymore, but, and I haven't actually personally made butter. I had someone explain to me just the other day, how do you do it? I think you just turn a little crank and eventually there's butter, right? With the milk, you all can give a much better lecture than I just gave, but you understand how that works. Just turn the crank, eventually it comes out. Well, that's the way anger is. If you turn the anger crank, eventually you get fights. That's what anger produces. Destruction, fighting, people at each other's throat, people killing, attacking, hating, destroying, running each other down. Anger is destructive. And just so that the, I love the poetry of this too, because milk producing butter sounds like a positive thing. So just in case you don't get the idea that it's productive, twisting a nose produces blood. That gives the idea of what anger really does. Probably more pictures what anger does than the first illustration, but both have their point. So anger destroys community. Now here I'm going to surprise you and say the anger of a righteous king is directed at and destroys evildoers in society. Anger is bad. It destroys your body. It destroys the community. But here I'm giving you a positive, although some people have a hard time feeling the positiveness of it. It's basically the function of a king in ancient Israel is the function, we don't have kings nowadays, on those who rebel in society. So this is a destructive force. The evildoers are put away or destroyed. It makes it so that the people who are law abiders and who are living normal lives and people and break bad people's weapons and that sort of thing. So it's a positive function ultimately, though in the interim it feels ouch. And that's what we see here. So, and I'll remind you of Romans 13, if you want something that doesn't use the word king. It says, rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong, he's God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the evildoer. That's why God designed governments. Now, not all governments do this well. Certainly no government does it perfectly. But the good function of government and the reason why God sustains authorities in government is to accomplish this purpose. It's his way in this present fallen world of restraining evil. He doesn't completely suppress it, but he restrains it. He holds it back. If we didn't have this, if we had anarchy, you would see a world that was chaotic and as bad as our world can be sometimes, you haven't seen anything. And just go to another country like the one where Vic is or others with a military or others or bandits are out of control and where there are no authorities who are performing this function well, and you will soon realize the value of a unit of people who kill people and break things that are bad. And so that's why we see in some of the proverbs I read you earlier, something like, a king's wrath is a messenger of death, but a wise man will appease it. That's a positive statement. A king's wrath is like the roar of a lion. He who angers him forfeits his life. Frequently, the lion is used as out of the animal kingdom to represent the king because of his kingliness and his power. The lion's a powerful beast, often destroying his prey just through the sound of his mighty roar. And so that's the way the king functions. So it's the king is destructive toward evildoers, and his anger is aroused when he sees those who do evil. People who go into police work, that's what they're after, right? Have you ever met anybody who's in police work? Sometimes people seem a little strange to us regular folks. But I'm glad we have them. They get a little imbalanced at times, some of them. But they're all about getting the bad guys and locking them up and tracking down the criminals and shooting them or whatever they need to do to keep law and order. I'm glad we have people like that. And they get angry. Of course, I get angry, too, at what people do. I read accounts in the paper of what criminals do, and it's terrible. And I'm glad those guys are out there, and they're getting angry about that, and they're using their anger to destroy those people. So there's, again, anger is destructive. Now we go back to more negative. Anger disintegrates your ability to make wise choices at all. And we see that in several of these proverbs. A quick-tempered man does foolish things. We all know that all too well, don't we? Even from personal experience. A patient man has great understanding, but a quick-tempered man displays folly. The idea of display here is he puts it on display, puts it out there, hangs it out there where everybody can see it. You know, when a quick-tempered man is out carrying on and throwing a temper tantrum or doing what he does in anger, Everybody pretty much knows it's going on. They see it. He's putting it all on display. He's making a fool of himself in front of everybody. A fool gives full vent to his anger, but a wise man keeps himself under control. It was popular some number of years ago, I recall, in psychology circles that the way to deal with anger is you just vent your anger. You express it, and you say vicious, nasty, ugly thing. And some Christians today still buy into that philosophy, and it's contrary to the Proverbs, and it's contrary to wisdom. That does not cure anger for you to let it out. It's not like some kind of pent-up steam. You know, you let the steam off, it lets the pressure down. That's like saying that pornography cures sexual immorality. The opposite, it fuels it. Venting, allowing a person to go on and rage, and that fuels your anger. It does not cure your anger at all. So, and it knows it's a fool who does this. You're making a fool of yourself. You're losing your ability to make wise choices at all because you become a fool because of your anger. Have you ever noticed, and all of us have lost our temper, after you've cooled off, you feel like a fool? You know why? Because you were a fool. Anger often distorts your view of the world so that you make stupid choices. Let's just get real about this. Now you look back and, you know, you may feel like you still have justification for your anger, but boy, you said some dumb things. Boy, you did some dumb things. And sometimes you can do some very dumb things that affect you and others for the rest of their lives. You may kill somebody. You may land yourself in jail. You may, you know, who knows what you can do. You may break up your marriage or your, all kinds of things that can happen when you give vent to anger, when you put your anger on display, when you rage. Anger destroys. That's what it was designed for, and that's what it does very well. Well, after having said all that, we can see the destructive power of anger, but that's not all the Bible says about anger. So if I just left it there, I've already given you a hint it can have some value when we look at governing authorities, but we're going to look further. There's more value to anger. One of the ways we see that anger is not always bad is that God is sometimes angry. Like Psalms, it says, I could pick 100,000 passages, I swear, but God is a righteous judge, a God who expresses his wrath every day. That says it pretty clearly. You say, okay, well, yeah, God, that's God. But what about Jesus in his humanity? Jesus was a perfect man in his walk on the earth. Everything he did was right and perfect. Jesus in his humanity was sometimes angry. The Gospels record this for us. The clearest verse is Mark chapter 3, verse 5, where Jesus looked around at the Pharisees, the religious leaders, they came to him and were questioning whether he should be healing somebody on the Sabbath. So rather than be excited about the fact that Jesus was healing somebody who needed healing, they were wondering whether he was crossing his T's and dotting his I's in terms of their view of the law. And so Jesus looked around, seeing their attitude. He looked around and says, in anger, deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. So Jesus was angry and he wasn't sinning in his anger. And then if there's any doubt left, we as believers are commanded to be angry in certain circumstances. Ephesians chapter 4, we actually covered this long time ago when I was teaching through the book of Ephesians. And I have a tape of it somewhere if you want to hear it, but it is actually a command. The NIV kind of covers the command. I forget exactly how it words that. I had to use a different translation simply because it covers up the meaning in the original for the purpose of smoothing it out, no doubt. I'm not trying to bash the NIV, but in this particular case, I just want to bring to your attention that we're commanded, be angry. That's a command. But be angry and sin not. So you have to be angry in a way that you're not sinning, but you are to be angry under certain circumstances. So because we're commanded to be angry, this means that at times it can be a sin not to be angry. Because if you don't obey a command of Scripture, then you're sinning. So there are times Scripture's commanding you to be angry under certain circumstances and certain times. And if you're not, you're actually sinning because you're disobeying the Scriptures. One of the early church fathers, there were a number of men in the early centuries of the Christian church who wrote quite prolifically, and we preserved many of their writings. And one of them, John Chrysostom, hope I'm pronouncing that right. He lived from 349 to 407. This guy lived a long time ago, about 1,700 years ago. And he put it this way. The person who becomes angry without reason sins. Further, the person who does not become angry when he has cause to be sins. And he goes on and elaborates, for an unreasonable patience is the hotbed of many vices. It fosters negligence. It stimulates not only the wicked, but above all the good to do wrong. So there is a time to be angry. It is an appropriate time to be angry. And if you're not, a lot of people have the idea Christianity is all about just not being angry, just being nice, always be nice. And that's not it. Of course, it's not, don't get me wrong, it's not the other extreme, be angry, be angry, be angry. No, there's a balance to be had here. What is that balance? Well, that's what we're going to explore next. Because we're going to look at, we've looked at the good of anger in the sense that it's commanded. And anger, as you saw with governing authorities, destroys evil, destroys problems. So it's good when anger destroys what's bad. So if anger is directed at bad things, that's good. But if anger is directed at people or good things that should not have anger directed at them, that's the problem. But let's look at this a little bit further. How does anger go wrong? And how do we distinguish a righteous anger from a sinful anger? That's the $50 question, or maybe the $150 question. If your anger is due to your recognition that a holy God has been offended by another's behavior, that anger is righteous. Think about Jesus' anger. Why was he angry at the religious leaders? At the stubbornness of their heart. They were in rebellion against God. They were uncaring of the man who needed healing. Those are men who are flying in the face of all that God is about. God's a God of compassion. God's a God of healing. God's a God that hates stubbornness in men. And they were putting all those characteristics on display by their behavior and their attempts to throttle what Jesus was doing. It made him angry, and it should have made him angry. It should have made us angry. It should make us angry when we see people who do these kinds of things who are have flagrant disregard for God, especially those who masquerade as religious people. It's even worse. On the other hand, if your anger is a result of not having your personal desires met, the anger is usually sinful. And we see this illustrated or spelled out a little more clearly in the book of James when he writes. James is an immensely practical book. I hope to cover it someday here. He says, what causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? So when you're having fights and arguments, a lot of the reason why you're fighting and getting mad and having, this is stirring up dissension like we saw earlier. The reason why that's happening is because you have these desires. You have things you want. You're not getting your way. That's a bad anger. That's not the kind of anger that we want to manifest as Christians. So that's a little bit of a starting point for us. We'll dig a little bit further into this issue. The ideal in the Bible is not no anger. We've already said that. It's not no anger, but it's slow anger. That is the ideal. Let me show this to you. Just look, quoting some of the Proverbs. It's a little bit masked in the sense that the translation that we use uses a different word, but it's okay because I think the word I use works as well. We see the word patient appearing in contrast to anger. And the word patient in many translations is translated slow to anger. And I'm not going to tell you that either one is literally right or wrong, because the literal Hebrew, it would make you laugh. You know what the literal Hebrew is for patient? Long of nose. You say, that sounds like Pinocchio. Yeah, we have a different idiom, right? And actually, I think there's some discussion in the scholarly works about why that particular phrase was used. That the word, one of the words, there's a number of words for anger. You see synonyms in our English, and that reflects a number of Hebrew words. That one of the main Hebrew words for anger is a word that means nose. And I think the idea there is that it's associated with the nose and noise that comes from the nose when you're angry, like somebody, like a bull, you know, is angry. It's that kind of, that's what the Hebrews picked up on. And so you say, well, what's this long of nose business? Well, it takes a long time before you get that noise out your nose, or it may be long of face. Now, the person who has a facial expression is relaxed, and so they're being patient. There's some, you know, discussion about what the word, but regardless of what it means, it's clear what the idiom means, exactly where the idiom came from. We could not be entirely sure. So long of nose, patient, but slow to anger is another one of the translations. So every place you see patient, you can think someone who's slow to get angry. Notice it doesn't mean you never get angry. It's not no anger. It just means that it takes you a while to get there. You're not ready to jump on that deal right away. You're gonna take your time. You're gonna be generally calm. It's gonna take something to get you to that point, and it has to be something significant. And so it says a patient or slow to anger man has great understanding. So there's wisdom in being slow to anger, but a quick-tempered man displays folly. We've already seen that. A hot-tempered man stirs up dissension. We focused on that before, but look at this. A patient or slow to anger man calms a quarrel. Think about how this works. You've seen this, right? If people are tempers are flared, maybe it's in the office or maybe it's in your home. People are on edge. They're a little bit ready to get into it. And someone comes in and they're calm. And they're managing things well. And they're talking in a calm voice. And they're working through things in a reasonable way with people. Next thing you know, people are talking calmly and reasonably. And things are worked out and it doesn't explode. You've seen that, right? That's what this proverb's talking about. And that's a good thing. That's what we need to do. Better a patient man, a slow to anger man, if you will, than a warrior. A man who controls his temper than one who takes a city. Here, a patient person, a slow to anger person, is being compared to a war hero. Now, I know it's not popular in our days to get excited about war heroes. I think that's unfortunate. I think it's something we've lost in our society, that we no longer do this. There was a day when awards were given. The military is very good at this. I think they still give these awards. They're just not as appreciated or publicized as they once were. But I can remember a day when these war heroes would talk about how they went in and they risked their own lives for their comrades, and they took so many people, and they were being shot at, and they were full of, you know, shrapnel and machine gun fire, and they just kept going. They were brave, and so on and so forth. They were heroes, and they are heroes, and because they're fighting for us. But better than even a war hero is someone who is able to control his temper, because a war hero may be able to take control of a city, but it's harder to take control of your own soul than it is for a war hero to take control of a city. You get the idea? And if everybody was taking control of their own soul, you wouldn't need war heroes. But that's not going to happen, so we still need war heroes. But those are the ideas that are involved there. So this is a person who's slow to anger, and the way you can be slow to anger is by controlling your temper. Not venting it, controlling it. And we'll talk more about how to do that in a moment. It's not strictly willpower. A man's wisdom gives him patience, i.e. makes him slow to anger. It is his glory to overlook an offense. Now, you and I know every day in life people do things that offend us. Maybe they're sins, maybe they're not. It's little stuff. And if you get wound up about every little thing, you're going to be a very angry person. It's not appropriate. There are so many things you just have to overlook. I'm horrible at this, unfortunately. You know, I mean, it makes me mad when I get in a grocery store and it's just 20 items are left and they got 22 items or 30 items, you know, or 50 items. I don't even care. I mean, that makes me mad. And I suppose in a sense, there's room for a little anger there. But in the big scheme of things, okay? Or somebody cuts in front of me without signaling. Or even cuts in front of me if they do signal, and doggone it, they maybe missed the light. That may not be righteous anger, you think? So, sometimes we have to overlook offenses. Now, we don't want to go too far with this. You don't want to overlook everything, because now you get into that category where there's no anger, you don't care, you're just going to be nice all the time, and you never draw any lines, you never take a stand on anything. That's bad also. But in the little stuff, I think there's a bunch of literature and stuff out now. Don't sweat the small stuff. My dad likes that. It's not particularly Christian, I don't think. But it's not a bad thing to think about. That's the idea here. Don't sweat the small stuff. Oh, you can overlook an offense, and that's glorious for a man who's slow to anger. That's his glory, that he does that. And what's our model for slow to anger? Our model for slow anger is the Lord himself. Over and over and over in the Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, by the way, God characterizes himself as slow to anger. And you see this, for example, when he passes before Moses, a very famous passage, Exodus 34. The Lord, the compassionate, gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness and rebellion and sin. God characterizes himself this way over and over. This is the Old Testament where everybody says God in the Old Testament is the God of anger and hate. God in the New Testament is the God of love. Not so. Not so. Here's the Old Testament. This is not a one-off verse. I'm not going to quote them all for you, but there are tons of them. Look them up. Get a concordance out. But notice, the last phrase I hadn't read yet. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. So God doesn't have no anger. God will ultimately punish those who are guilty. But he's slow to. He puts up with a lot. And, you know, we look at God acting in society, you know, like that story that Sproul told about the guy where the Ark of the Covenant was going to fall and he stuck out his hand and he died. And we think, oh, God wasn't patient at all there. Are you kidding? You know how many sins God overlooked in that guy's life and could have struck him dead over any of those? You know, Sproul explained all this. God is overlooking so much in our life. We've lowered the bar so low that we think we're cool. And God ought to just be just fine with everything we're doing. That's because we've got our standard down in the gutter. If we had God's standard and God's point of view and saw sin the way God sees it, we'd be freaking out. When's God going to act? It'd be like the saints in Revelation, you know, during the stuff that's being described. And say, how long, O Lord, how long before you act and move in and end this thing, you know? That's what we'd be saying. But God says, oh, I'm slow to anger. I'm going to put up with a lot. I will act. I may act in ways that you don't understand that seem almost random to you, but I am slow to anger. That's the way we need to be, calm. God doesn't get wound up and excited. He's not on the edge of his seat. Going, what's happening? I'm losing control. He's calm. In contrast to slow anger, sinful anger tends to either react too quickly, like we see the patient man has great understanding, but the quick-tempered man displays folly. So one of the things we do, we see something go wrong, we want to jump on it. I mean, you don't even give it a second, and we're all over it. Now, if something is really hideous that takes place and requires instant action, you know, someone comes up and attacks a young child or something, yeah, you know, it needs to be instantaneous. But I'm talking about, you know, like I said, somebody cuts in front of you in traffic and you give them the finger, you know, you need to be slow to anger, if any anger at all. And the other thing we do, that's probably in this category too, we tend to react too quickly and we tend to overreact. A hot-tempered man stirs up dissension. Hot-tempered, we get hot. And it can be something, you know, in the big scheme of things, somebody listens to what you got hot about and they're like, yeah? You got that mad about that, huh? You know, and I look back sometimes on periods of my life when I got hot about certain things, and I kind of wonder, I was kind of being a fool, wasn't I? So we tend to overreact. We tend to react too quickly. This is instead of slow to anger, patient. And there are two extremes in the way that sinful anger shows itself. And this can be instructive to us when we're looking at our own anger. One, we've talked about already, ventilation. This is where you blow up, raising your voice, name-calling, using profanity, throwing, hitting, kicking things, biting sarcasm, and various other acts of vengeance. We've all been there, done that. We've all seen this. This is blow-up anger. There's another little form of it. It seems to sort of, well, they're trying to put it under the radar. It doesn't really work. It's internalization. This is anger. Cry, pout, sulk, retreat to another room. The silent treatment. Okay? So you got different personality types play out here, right? And some of the blow-up types. I mean, you make them mad, you know, it's like, hey, what you see, what you get. Bar! You know, oh, great, thanks. You know. And as the other types there, they're above that. They're not going to let this get to them. You're acting kind of strange. Anything wrong? Nothing. That's an angry statement. Now, where's the anger? It's not being manifest outwardly yet. It's being turned inward. Now, anger destroys. So who is that person destroying at that point? Themselves. Now, in their heart, they're saying lots of nasty things about the other person. They're thinking, well, he's going to see how mad I am. He's going to know. He's going to feel guilty. I hope he feels guilty. I hope he comes to realize what he did to me. That was just terrible. You know, or she. I'm not going to make it all masculine. I hope she comes to realize and she, boy, she, yeah, she'll know. I'm above getting, I'm going to be like that. I'm not going to be that blow up person. I've got control. Nothing is wrong in my life. That's anger. It's just inside. There's no difference. It's different manifestation, granted. He may even try to argue, well, at least I'm not destroying anything. Well, here's what happens, though, eventually. Some people blow up first and then clam up. And, bah! And all, but then they're over there, they're just nothing. And then you have the other type. They clam up, and they're building up, and they're building up. You might not even know it. They might even put on the nice face. Hello, how are you? Everything's fine. You know, and you're going along, and everybody's happy, and oh, that's good. And then one day, kaboom! You know, you did something like really small. You know, Jay Adams, a Christian counselor, likes to tell this story. He calls this gunny sacking, is his word for it. I think I've used this illustration before. Every time somebody does something wrong, you whip out your gunny sack, and you put that little bad thing in the gunny sack. So you're not overlooking offenses. You're looking like you're overlooking offenses. What you're really doing is restoring up offenses. Kind of like 1 Corinthians 13 says, you're not supposed to do, keep a record of wrongs. And you keep storing up and storing up and storing up. And nobody knows you're dragging around the gunny sack because you're kind of holding it down. You're walking along smiling. And then one day the gunny sack gets so big it can't hold it anymore. And you go to stuff that one last thing in there and the gunny sack explodes over some little tiny thing. Like maybe he left the cap off the toothpaste tube or something. And you think, my goodness. I mean, I understand we talked about putting the cap back on a toothpaste tube or putting the toilet lid down, whatever things happen in your life that make you mad. But did it really require a massive blow-up? Was it an atomic bomb? Was it that important? Well, what you don't realize is that gunny sack was full. You'd done all kind of stuff that made them angry. You just didn't get to talk about it because it wasn't being discussed. You see? So anger was being internalized. I don't know, none of you have ever done any of this stuff. It doesn't happen in your home. It just happens in my home sometimes. Okay. Well, it's time to talk about how to heal our anger. How do we heal our anger? I'm going to give you a short outline here. This is the last section until we get to the Lord's Supper piece. Admit it. Analyze it. Transform it. That's it. Now, let me look at each one of these just briefly. Admit your anger. Anger is difficult to admit because we tend to want to hide it from others and even ourselves. You remember this one that I read earlier? A malicious man disguises himself with his lips, but in his heart he harbors deceit. Though his speech is charming, that's what I just did a while ago, everything's fine, speech is charming. Though his speech or her speech is charming, do not believe him. Seven abominations fill his heart. I like that scriptural language of seven abominations fill his heart. And he's speaking very happy. You never know it. His malice may be concealed by deception, but his wickedness will be exposed in the assembly. So in the community, it's going to come out. People that know him or they're going to push his buttons, whatever. It's going to come out. You're going to get there. Don't be thrown off. So we tend to hide our anger from others. We tend to hide our anger from ourselves, honestly, folks, don't we? I want to call myself anything but an angry man. I have a strong personality. I have strong opinions. I'm a person who believes in a cause. I got lots of ways of, and I'm not angry. I'm not mad. No. I'm not mad. So if you can't admit that you're angry, you can't even begin to work on it. This is similar to what the advice, I think it's good advice, it's given to people who are addicted to alcohol or drugs. And what's the first step? Those of you who have been through these step programs and so forth, you know, they're not all perfect, but they have a few good bits of advice in them. One of them is the first step is what? You admit you have a problem, right? And if your anger is going to be hiding and masquerading, like this man here, being described in Proverbs, you're never going to get to step two. So step one is admit it. Seems simple, but that's not where it ends. You can't say, okay, all right, I'm angry. I got mad. I blew my temper. Okay. Well, don't stop there. What do we do next? Analyze your anger. Ugh, I hate that. I hate analyze. Some people hate analyzing. But you've got to. You've got to do this. You distinguish, first of all, between sinful versus righteous anger. We've given you some general bullet points how to figure that out in a big picture sort of way. It could be that you have a righteous anger. It could be you're right in being angry. Be careful with that, because our tendency is, because we want to hide our anger or we want to make our anger look right, we'll tend to call it righteous anger when it's not so much. Okay, but there is such thing as righteous anger, and we shouldn't just be unwilling to ever say that. I think we should think it through. Identify the circumstances that provoke the anger. Go back and think through it. This is something you meditate on later. You're not going to be able to do it on the spot. What circumstances led to my becoming angry? What happened to provoke me to anger? Okay? Then once you do that, then the next thing is identify specific motives and thoughts associated with the anger. You see what we're doing here? We're going anywhere. We're going into the heart. Religion tries to change outward behavior. That's not what the scriptures do. Scriptures go to where it all starts, where it all comes from, out of the heart. And if you don't do that, then you're just, as Jesus would say, just cleaning the outside of the dish or the cup. You know, you got all this gooky junk on the inside of the cup, and you wash the outside and say, it's clean. No, it's not. You have to fret about the inside. You've got to delve into what motivates you. What is going on in your heart? We don't want somebody who says, okay, I get it. I'm going to quit. On temper tantrum. I know. I get that. I'm with it. You know, I'm on that. No, you don't get that. This is how you get that. You dig in and you figure out what motivated it. What did I desire or long for when I became angry? Remember, James says, somebody thwarts or blocks something that we desired, and that's what makes us angry. Isn't that true? You think about times you got angry. And you know what's going to happen? If you start thinking about this, I've done this at times, and a lot of times it takes about 10 seconds, and you realize why you got angry, what made you angry, and you're embarrassed. Even if nobody saw you get angry about it, you went, that's what made me angry? I tell you one that gets me all the time. In sports, I play racquetball, you know. And if I make a bad shot, or if the other guy gets in a good shot, it makes me mad. And I think to myself, okay, now why did that make me angry? What was my desire? My desire was to be the great racquetball player who won the game, and the other person saying, oh, you're so great. I wouldn't play it up like that. I'd be much more humble. I'd cover it up. It would be okay by the time I got done dressing it up. But isn't that really what it's all about? Why would I be angry that the guy made a good shot? Oh, I can't believe he made that shot. I didn't use the right technique. You know? If he's going to get a good shot like that, at least if he, you know, does, he used, I've worked for hours on the right technique, and I can't get that shot to work, and he did it, and makes me mad. You know? And I've played racquetball with people who have that anger, and they manifest it on the court constantly. In fact, they're kind of annoying to play with. I got one guy I play, every time I score a point, or do anything where he loses a point, if one's happening, the other's happening. If he gets a hold of the racquetball, before he hands it back to me, he turns real red, and he takes that ball, and he hits it as hard as he can against the sidewall, and he lets out some kind of a, and he hands it back. And I said, nice shot, huh? You know, I've learned to be a little more dressed up than that. I don't do that, okay? But this is going on in the heart. This is going on in the heart. And it's embarrassing. What did I desire or long for? You think about it. You think when you got angry, what made me angry? Or the fact that somebody, you know, I like this, getting angry at inanimate objects. Does that make any sense at all? The traffic light change, that makes me mad. Okay? I guess we can. Now I'm smart. I figure out how to, I'm going to blame the people who control the traffic lights. Those people didn't set that right correctly. If I was setting traffic lights, it would not have gone off right. Now look at it. All this traffic over here, there's nobody over there. You know, it makes me mad. Those people are incompetent. That's unrighteous. That's bad. I'm going to have to call those people. Some of you can't identify with this, I'm sure. But, you know, why does that make me mad? Well, I didn't manage my time well, and I'm running late, and so I'm going to look bad wherever I show up, and it's because the traffic light. Mm-hmm. You can get embarrassed about these things if you think about them, but you need to be embarrassed. So what did I say to myself in my heart when I became angry? And notice the proverb, I quoted this earlier. Do not say, I'll do to him as he's done to me. I'll pay that man back for what he did. Who's this person talking to? This is a conversation, right? Something's being spoken. Who's it being spoken to? To yourself, right? Here's the dirty little secret about anger. The thing that makes you angry is not what happened, but what you tell yourself happened. Now think about that. Now you might be, maybe you're getting mad at that because, well, it did happen. Okay, maybe it did happen. But whether it happened or not, it's what you tell yourself is what's going to make you mad. Does that make sense? So, and I've been in these kinds of arguments before. I'm arguing with the person's getting very, very angry with me. And I say, why are you so angry? I said, because you did what you did just simply to cheat me out of some money, or you did what you did just to, and they have this horrible thing that I did in their mind. And I'm like, now I realize I'm a sinner. I could be self-deceived. Maybe I was really doing that and I've deceived myself. I don't think so. That wasn't what was in my heart. And I said, no, that's not why I did that. Oh, yeah, okay, go ahead and defend yourself. It's not going to change anything. I know what you're up to. Gee, I can't win here, can I? What's making that person angry? It's what they told themselves I did. And I think about it, I think, well, if I really believe what they believe, I'd be mad at me too. They have a right to be angry if they were right, but they're not right. I don't believe. And they're not willing to listen to me explain why I did what I did. You see, have you ever had it happen to you? Somebody misreads you? And then here's the tricky part. Once that person has done that and made that commitment, verbally especially, and you get it out of them, and you explain, you finally get them to listen to you, and you show them, and they say, all right, I'll take your word for it. You're thinking, do they really believe that? But you see what's going on here is now they've committed themselves to this other view, and so even though they have to back off of it, they still expressed all the feelings, they still have the feelings churning within them, and they can't let go of it, because they've already committed themselves to that feeling that was based on a wrong view. Now they're kind of stuck for a while. And, a day, a month, a week later, they'll come to their senses, and by then everybody's forgotten about it, and we just move on. And so this is the problem that happens. And we do it to ourselves too. I'm making it another person, in this case, making me the good guy here, but this happens my way too, obviously. It happens to all of you, I will venture a bet. So, we need to understand the ability to discern thoughts and motives, especially when you're experiencing intense emotion, is an essential skill for the Christian who intends to pursue holiness. Do you want to be a real Christian? Do you want to really pursue holiness? I mean, some people are very honest and say, no, not really. I want to be that Christian that goes to church and looks good and, I do some of the basic things, but I don't want to get real serious about this business. But if you want to be serious as a Christian, you want to be a real Christian, a Christian whose heart is changing, you need to be thinking about what you're thinking. And especially when intense emotion is involved. Why is that? Because intense emotion is telling you something very important to you. Otherwise, you wouldn't be having the intense emotions. And don't you think that what's important to you matters in terms of your holiness? You bet your life it does. You'd be surprised what's really important to you when you think about it. So that's what you do. You look and you develop this essential skill. And it's difficult to detect wrong thoughts because they're often based on desires that may seem legitimate when in fact they are either wrong desires. It just could be something you say, well, I wanted that. I'm dating this guy or I'm dating this girl and we're not married yet, but we're planning on getting married and I want to go to bed. So it's, I'm mad when they don't want to do that with me. That's a wrong desire. That's what James talks about. And he says, each one is tempted by his own evil desire. He's dragged away and enticed. After the desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. When you sin, it's because you had a desire first. It was based on an evil desire. And if you let sin grow up, as it says here, it leads to death. In other words, you prove yourself an unbeliever. Or God takes you out as a Christian, whatever. So that's one thing. You can have wrong desire. Or you may have a legitimate desire that is desired inordinately. You desire it too much. You've made a good thing an ultimate thing. And this is where James, I'm picking up the next verse from one we quoted earlier. You want something, but you don't get it. You kill and covet because you cannot have what you want. You quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God. Instead of going to God with your desires and needs, you're going to take it out and have a battle. You're going to have a war with somebody who's blocking your desires. And you're going to do it to such a degree that you're not slow to anger anymore. Now you're sinful in your anger. And you know how something, a good thing becomes an idol? It's when you're willing to sin to get it. Simple way to test it. Are you willing to sin to get that thing that you want? Even if it's an honest, genuine desire. You know, I wanted to have a nice vacation. I wanted to have a nice car. I wanted to have a day where people just leave me alone, for heaven's sakes, for one day. Is that too much to ask? I wanted to watch the football game, for heaven's sakes. You know, whatever that is, that important thing to you, it could be a legitimate desire. Nothing wrong with any of those things I just listed. But if it becomes a demand and you have that kind of attitude, it's an idol. You've made a good thing an ultimate thing. And it can generate anger, unrighteous anger. Okay, so then you have the last thing. You have to admit your anger. You have to identify, analyze your anger. And then you need to transform your anger. Evaluate the nature of the anger-producing thoughts and motives biblically. What does the Bible say about what I wanted when I became angry? This is where you bring the Bible in. So, okay, let's say you get to the Bible. Okay, yeah, I know. I just wanted to have a day to myself. You know, oh, yeah, I know. I wanted to go to bed with that person. And you got to look at that. Well, what's the Bible say about that kind of attitude and that kind of demand about that kind of thing? It says, you know, don't gloat when your enemy falls. I mean, don't we all want to gloat? Yeah, that guy made me mad. I'm so glad he fell. I'm so glad he deserves him right. Don't gloat when your enemy falls. When he stumbles, do not let your heart rejoice, or the Lord will see and disapprove and turn his wrath away from him. Interesting. If you, this according to this passage, and it's not the only passage that teaches this, if you show inordinate anger and gloating when your enemy falls, the Lord will actually ratchet down what he was going to do in that circumstance because you've already done part of it. So you're kind of productive if you're trying to hurt the person, which is not what you're supposed to be doing anyways, but it's just showing. And you shouldn't be doing it. What's the Bible say about that? Don't do that. You know, I shouldn't be gloating when the other guy gets a bad shot and I make the point. Right? Let's use that as a simple illustration. Shouldn't be, haha. You know, which, and we'll do that sort of kiddingly, but sometimes the joke's not quite there, you know. You just, hey, all right, missed that shot. Good, my point. What does the Bible say about what I said to myself when I became angry? Remember, it's so important what you say to yourself. And again, that same passage, do not say, I'll harm him as he's done to me. I'll pay that man back for what he did. What's the Bible say about that? It says, do not say it. And you said it. So the Bible goes against what you did. Now, guess what? This means you're going to have to know your Bible, too. I know all of us know it to one degree or another, but this means you need to be in digging around in the Word and thinking about how it applies to your life. That's what I'm trying to teach on and show more videos on, more practical things. We need this stuff. I need it. I always preach to me first before I preach to y'all, as you hopefully can tell. And then you're not done still. Okay, now you've seen, first of all, you admitted you're angry. Then you identify what it is that made you angry. What were the thoughts, the feelings, the patterns? So if you trace it out, then you've identified what the Bible says about those thoughts and feelings and so forth. Now, last step, develop an alternative biblical thoughts and motive to replace the unbiblical ones. The Bible talks again and again and again. We've talked about this before. It compares repentance or growth to changing clothes. Take off the sinful clothes, put on the grace clothes, as it were, the God fearing clothes. So you don't just get rid of a bad habit, but you replace it with a good habit. Otherwise, you'll end up back at that bad habit again. You just keep going back and keep going, why do I keep ending up back here? Because you didn't replace it. You didn't put something else in. It was serving a function in your life. That's why you did it. But you need to get the right stuff in there serving the right function in your life. So what should I have said to myself when I became angry? That's the question you need to ask yourself. What should I have wanted more than my own selfish desires? And here's an example it gives, and this is quoted in the New Testament. If your enemy's hungry, give him food to eat. If he's thirsty, give him water to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. Now, it's a little strange phrase about burning coals on the head. And some people think, well, What are you trying to get him? I mean, that sounds bad, pouring hot coals on his head. It's like, that doesn't sound like you're giving him food and drink. That's cool. But then you turn around and heap hot coals on his head. What's that all about? It's an idiom or expression. Some debate about it, but the most probable meaning of it is that you will cause him, it will prick your enemy's conscience. Think about it. The enemy did something wrong to you, whoever your enemy is, whatever they did wrong. They did something nasty. And they may not admit, they know in their heart of hearts they did that to you. You know, they don't want to talk about it, they don't want to admit it. So they know they did you wrong. What are they expecting back from you? What they deserve. They're expecting you to come back all hot and inflamed. They've been pushing your buttons. Of course they expect you to come back screaming and yelling and doing the stuff that you typically do. And they're all braced. They're steeled up for it, right? They're ready for it. Here it comes. And they're going to go, they're going to act shocked, but they were ready for it. This frequently happens. And instead you come back and you return a blessing for what they did. It's like knocking the wind out of them in a way. See, that sounds bad to knock the wind out, but what I mean in a good way. I have a guy I play racquetball with. I'm sorry for all the racquetball illustrations just came to my mind this morning. Hope you can appreciate that. But I have a guy I play racquetball with. He's an Arab. He's a brain surgeon. And he's some big shot or whatever. But he claims to be a Christian, but he's a very vulgar person in many ways. Cusses like a sailor. And every once in a while, in the middle of the game, you know, if we're having fun and we get that point on him that he didn't like or whatever, he turns around, just anger all over his face, and he says, F you! You know, he doesn't say F, you see. Okay? And he means it, man. He is flames coming out of his eyes. You think, why do you play with that guy? I don't know. I really don't. But I just play with him. I kind of like him in a way. I don't know. Anyhow, he says, F you! You know? And I could say back to him, F you! You know, and say it louder. That's what the natural man wants to do, right? You know what I've gotten to say to him now? May the Lord bless you and keep you and cause his face to shine upon you. Every time he says that, that's what I say back. He said, well, that's a little self-righteous. No, it's not. I smile. He knows what, because see, he knows the Bible a little bit. I mean, he professes to be a Christian. He knows what I'm saying. And you ought to see the look, he melts. Now, he doesn't repent usually, but he just takes all the air out, and he goes back playing. He won't do that again for months. And then he forgets in a moment of heat or anger, and he turns around and says, F you! I say, may the Lord bless you and keep you and cause his face to shine upon you. I hate playing with this guy. But actually, he does appreciate it at one level. I can tell you that, but it seems crazy. Okay, so that's, you develop that alternative. Hey, here's another one. The guy, you know, okay, so my anger was he got the good shot, and it made me mad that he got that good shot. Hey, how about saying, great shot. Good job. You know, you never hear that on the court, you know. Sometimes you do, but it's pretty rare. You know, you watch some of these major sports events, especially racquetball, like the worst sport ever. The major league racquetball, whatever. I watched one time a major game, and I was embarrassed what they said to each other. It's like everybody's angry, and, you know, every time... It would have been neat if I could have watched him, like, good sportsmanship, you know, like, man, that was a great shot. I don't know how you did it. That's awesome. I wish I could shoot like that, you know? So replace your behavior. All right. So we've looked at anger, and we've been looking at our anger. And now we're going to transition to the Lord's Supper. Because while we've been looking at our anger, the ultimate anger we have to face is the righteous anger that God has against us. You see, remember, God is slow to anger, but he will punish the wicked. Remember where I read that to you. So it's not going to go away. And the fact of the matter is, even in the area of anger, especially in the area of anger, we're most guilty. And try as we will, and I hope we all engage some of these patterns. I hope you'll take some of this seriously and it will help you develop a more holy walk with Christ. That's my hope for myself. You're not going to succeed 100%. And ultimately, God can't accept you unless you are perfect in his sight. But even at that, I mean, the incongruity of what God has forgiven us, when you recognize that, you know, I might sin against you, but that's in a specific instant. Every sin that any of us commit is ultimately and mostly against God first. Right? That's a biblical truth. That's why David could say, against thee and thee only have I sinned. Well, actually, he sinned against everybody in Israel, Bathsheba and all the rest of them. That, he wasn't denying that. He was just simply pointing out that in terms of priority, the real sin was against God. Every sin you commit is against God, even the ones you don't know. And God knows your sin so perfectly because he knows your heart perfectly and he knows his requirements so perfectly, which you don't. Can you imagine what a list God would have against you if he decided to count them all? Who could stand? That's what we said last time, remember? And then this time I want to read something out of the Gospels. I'm just going to read through it and it illustrates. And it's a familiar story, but I want us to think about this in terms of anger, in terms of the way we treat other people, because this is what I hope will turn our hearts as we turn our hearts toward the Lord's Supper and what it really represents in relation especially to what we just talked about this morning. I'm going to read from Matthew 18, verses 23. We'll have read to verse 35 when I read to the end. I'm just going to read it. It says, therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 talents, that's millions of dollars, was brought to him. Since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. The servant fell on his knees before him. Be patient with me, he begged, and I will pay back everything. The servant's master took pity on him and canceled the debt and let him go. Now you know where this goes. But when that servant, the one that was forgiven the debt, went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. That's a couple thousand dollars. A decent chunk of money, but not the millions that he owed, right? And he grabbed him and began to choke him. Pay back what you owe me, he demanded. His fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, be patient with me and I'll pay you back. But he refused. Instead, he went off and he had the man thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. How are you going to do that when you're in prison? And when the other servants saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed and went and told their master everything that had happened. You see the incongruity here. Then the master called the servant in. You wicked servant, he said. I cancel all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you? In anger, his master turned him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all that he owed. And this is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive your brother from your heart. Now, this is a familiar story, and I doubt there's a person in this room who hasn't heard this a dozen times. But think about this in relation to the anger that you have toward others. As we've been walking through this, I hope you've been thinking about your own life. And think about, how am I going to motivate myself to change in my anger? Is it going to be for willpower? All right, I'm going to do it. I would argue with you that you need to look at this story and realize you are in the story. Who are you? You're the one that owed millions of dollars and God forgave you in Jesus Christ. And you're the one that turns around and wants to make everybody else pay every penny. That's who we are. And when you realize what God's forgiven you, some decency somewhere within you ought to come out that says, if God's done that for me, why can't I do that for others? That's the Christian life. That's it in a nutshell. And so as we look at the elements and we look at God, the reason why he could forgive us, and this is where the story sort of breaks down in a way, because the debt was actually paid. God poured out anger, wrath, that's what wrath is, on Jesus Christ, on his body, and when he spilled his blood. And that's what these elements stand for the very thing we've been talking about this morning. You see all this ties in? It always comes back to this, doesn't it, every time? Because that's what the Christian life is, it's the gospel. If I can ask, I didn't pick ushers this morning, can I have the same ushers that served last time come up? I know it was Nathan and Jim, was it, I think, or... You know who you are. I'm sorry for not having arranged that ahead of time. If you all would pass out the elements, and then we'll... if you all would just hold the elements as you receive them. We're going to pass out the bread and the wine both. And then we'll just take them one at a time. And we'll eat together and we'll drink together. And then we'll pray and you'll be dismissed. That's how we'll work it. Our Father and our God, we do thank you that you have shown us mercy. You've forgiven us the... figuratively speaking, millions and millions of dollars. Don't even begin to come close to the thousands of others that we generated great anger against others for owing us thousands. and yet you've been long-suffering, slow to anger. And you've demonstrated that most of all in your Son, Jesus Christ. Lord, may we trust in Him. Thank You that we are cleansed by His blood, that the fact that His body was broken and resurrected for us, that He might walk in newness of life, we therefore ask that we too, as He was raised, might be raised to walk in newness of life, both in our spiritual walk as we apply these principles day in, day out. Life is every day, not just in church. And then ultimately, as we look forward to that final day, we will be raised with a new body to be in Your presence, never to sin again, never to experience anger, never to experience all the horrible effects of the fallen world, but experience nothing but Your glorious love throughout the ages. We look forward to that and being in Your presence. In His name we pray. Amen.